On March 16, 2000, two sheriff's deputies were shot in Atlanta. Jameel Al-Amin, a Muslim leader and former Black Power activist, was convicted. But the evidence was shaky, and the whole truth didn't come out during the trial. My name is Mosi Secret, and when I started investigating this case in my hometown, I uncovered a dark truth about America. From Tenderfoot TV, Campside Media, and iHeart Podcasts, Radical is available now. Listen to the new podcast, Radical, for free on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
One note of housekeeping, we are winding down our Patreon at the end of October. There will be no more Patreon. We'll just be coming out on Wednesdays for free for everybody. Thank you so much to our Patreon family for supporting us through all this time. We love you. I thank you so much for the support. I look forward to continuing to rock on with this show with you for years to come.
Okay, ready?
Think what you know, and it's about a time when you get yourself in. We are I wanna know some of the things she's done. I think about everyone you need. I'm holding it, things are real now. I have you seen you wanting you. Hey,
it's a ratio. Okay, though. It's a ratio. Okay, though.
That might be the best question I've ever been asked.
All right, let's talk about the fourth season. It was a departure in many ways from what you've done. Why make it a musical?
I got to tell you the truth, Trey, because we talk the truth on this.
Let's go.
The fact is, man, is that I was really, really depressed and I felt really stuck and I felt like I needed to do something that was going to bring me some life because making the show was killing me and making it a musical was going to give me some life. Every season of the show, I try to give myself as a filmmaker an opportunity that the industry hasn't given me or that I haven't been able to make happen. And telling stories through musicals has just been in my soul for a really long time, and I wanted to do it. And I also felt like there was a link between what I needed to say this season and musicals. With a musical, there's this like inherently performative aspect to it. People are literally bursting out into song, and there's an artifice to it. But that artifice also like expresses something that's true and maybe even truer than if the people were just talking to each other. I really wanted to comment on how performative racial politics has become, the ways in which like dualism in a marketplace kind of dictate the things we get to say, the things that, you know, we say that actually catch on with people. I felt there were a lot of similarities between doing a musical and those ideas. And so, you know, I had to go with the thing that was burning in my heart to do it. And I do understand that, you know, some people couldn't swallow it. I have to say that happens every season, though.
Justin Simien is the creator and director of the Netflix hit Dear White People, which has come to an end with a musical season that I liked a lot. Some people didn't. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the difficulty of making Dear White People and difficulty of making television at all. And Justin's next project, Haunted Mansion, which he's super excited and proud about. This is a great look into the life and the work of an ongoing director, creator, who's trying to make Black and queer and interesting work. And it's a challenge in white supremacist Hollywood. So let's go. It's my man, Justin Simien, on Touré Show. So I just want to reflect for a minute on the full circle that you have taken in your career in terms of, you know, you created this film, you know, that had success and it became a TV show. And now you've run a whole gamut of the show. So you've sort of, you know, this is like your first big baby has sort of like, right, like grown up and now like, you know, leaving the nest.
Yes.
How's that? How's that for you?
Ready. I'm ready for my child to leave the nest and start paying their own bills and looking after themselves. I mean, it feels, you know, on one hand, it feels great. It's an accomplishment. It's something that a lot of people, while I was making it, really didn't think was possible for it. And at the same time, it's not, it's been really hard fought and hard, you know, it's been difficult to earn that. And you don't really talk about all that stuff on the junket or on the press tours. But it's been, I don't know, it's been kind of like a spirit quest or something. It's like I really grew up because of this in ways that were wonderful and ways that were really, really difficult. But I don't feel a sense of regret or longing or sadness. Like I feel great that it is completed, that this sort of initial burst of inspiration that got me in this industry, you know, has come to a stopping point.
You're ready. You're ready to let it go.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Cause the beauty of the structure, you could have let, you know, Sam and them graduate, usher in a new group of students. It's something of a new show, and yet this, and yet not, and like, you know, start over, you know, with like a new clash, new inciting incident. Like, you know, you could have.
Sure. And if making TV shows was like as simple as like waking up in the morning, and be like, you know what I want to do today? I want to do this, you know, sure. That's not how it's gone. And, you know, it's not necessarily like even my call that this was the end, but it feels right to me. To be honest with you, I don't know if I could keep making the show in the way we've been making it. And specifically the way that TV works now, at least in streaming world, is you do something, it comes out, you wait a few months, and then you find out if it's going to continue. It's not really quite how TV used to work before. And that's a totally different environment to make a serialized TV show than other situations. So, you know, each one of these seasons for me has been like a massive movie. You know, it's been this giant sort of extremely long creative process where you're managing lots of different people. You're in a marketplace, so you're dealing with capitalism and white supremacy and all the shit that comes with that. All of that stuff is very difficult to do and also try to maintain a pure kind of artistic statement. And it's been an honor to get to do that at the start of my career. But it's also not necessarily something that I, as an artist, as a person, needed to continue. I think my hope for it is already happening in that, like, we did introduce a format. I wouldn't call it a genre, but it's definitely a format, a way to sort of take political discourse and the thoughts and feelings of a marginalized group and turn it into, you know, weekly entertainment, episodic entertainment. That is something we figured out how to do on, and that a lot of shows are doing now because we were part of, you know, the many artists that helped popularize that thing. And I would love for there to be a Dear Blank, you know, ongoing universe. But I don't have the money to pay for that. So until somebody offers that, you know, we're all kind of shit out of luck there.
Well, you talk about the impact, you mentioned the impact of white supremacy on what you have been doing, which is interesting to hear because this is one of the blacker shows on television. Sam and others say very aggressive black things. They stand up to whiteness in very aggressive ways. All but one, off the top of my head, all but one of the major characters are black, right? So where has white supremacy, are you saying, or white privilege impacted, blocked, affected what you were trying to do? Because from the outside, it looks like you were able to do pretty much whatever you wanted to do.
And that's the goal, you know? That's the goal of art. You want it to feel polished. You want it to feel cohesive. I mean, let's start with the budget of the show. Let's talk about how much each of those episodes cost versus similar shows or shows that are, frankly, a lot less ambitious, but with less black casts. you know, let's talk about the fact that, you know, it is a show that's not only dealing with Black people, but it's dealing with queer people. And a value is placed on that by the people who make TV. And we had to do a lot with a little. Huh. And that includes our releases, that includes, you know, coming back, that includes all of the negotiations and all the people that you have to put in place to make a season of TV, that includes the actual making of it itself. This thing about white supremacy is pretty pernicious and widespread. And it's unconscious too. It's not like there's evil person to put it all on or anything like that. But it's been a labor of love, but it's been a labor. It really has. And I think it's been worth it. But I would, you know, at the end of it, I can finally start to talk all of the things that I felt while I was doing it. And yeah. Those weren't all happy things, you know?
So I imagine it feels like you're saying on the set, dealing with the actors and the rest of the crew and the team, that was, I mean, it's hard because it's hard creative work, but that was fulfilling. Dealing with some of the other things was hard.
Yeah, I would say so. There's like a creative component to the, and all of the storytellers and all of that aspect of it is beautiful. I certainly know it was important to me at the beginning, and I feel like I did it as much as I could, you know, creating a safe space for people of color who typically don't get to do things that are ambitious or specific or, you know, kind of out there and fun or interesting, like giving them a safe space to be amazing artists. Was a really important part of my process. But what comes along with that is that I, you know, as the creator and showrunner, also have a responsibility to kind of absorb the sort of shock that causes in the wider industry and sort of fight a lot of battles before that really gets down to the creatives that I want to give space to do their work. And I'm not saying all this to complain. I'm saying this because, like, I otherwise it would go unsaid and be erased. From the experience, and people just sort of think that, like, oh, you get a TV show, it's at Netflix, you can do whatever you want, you're just out there, that's not what it is at all.
There is a perception that a Netflix show has less competition or less challenge because there's not a finite amount of, like, you know, ABC, there's a finite real estate. If you're not pulling your weight on Tuesday at 8:30, we will get something else that will. Mm-hmm. Netflix, you know, I mean, they don't even talk to us about the metrics and what the numbers are. We have no idea what, you know, like, what do you need to do to, like, keep them happy? And, like, you know, as long as some people are, and people will keep watching this for a long time. So where does the challenge come when Netflix has infinite real estate and, like, just as long as some folks watch it, you're good?
Well, that's not true. Just as long as some folks watch it, you're good is not true. I mean, there's been many high profile shows with great ratings, great audiences that get canceled or don't come back. Shows that go on for, some might say, too long. It's a giant corporation that is producing billions of hours of content, you know, it's bound to have some issues, you know, it's bound to be difficult from time to time. That perception of Netflix is not correct, not by any creator that I've spoken to that's worked there. It's incredibly challenging. And I think that one of the things that is perhaps most challenging about it is that because there aren't metrics that are readily available for people, you do wonder, well, what is the bar here? Exactly, like, what bar are we trying to meet? And that isn't really defined by the company for anybody, including at least for me. I mean, maybe some creatives have some insight, but I always had the feeling of we had to clear a bar that I also had to guess at what it was and where it was. And you know, you look at other shows and you look at other creatives and it's not all equal. It's not like we're all being given the same money and we're not all being given the same resources or the same time. And there's really no explanation as to why. You have to sort of sort that out yourself. it really is it's an interesting place, because like without Netflix, I don't think I ever would have made Dear White People as a show. I don't think, you know, there were other places that wanted the show, but it just was a unique opportunity to do something like this. And I think a lot of creatives, especially who like are getting started, have had the benefit of the fact that Netflix makes so much stuff that they're willing to take chances on people. But that there's other stuff too on the other side of that. There are other kinds of resources that you need besides just an opportunity to make television, to make great television, and to make people feel good while they're making it. And those are not equal. Those resources are not equal.
There's the metrics that you need to meet are invisible. They're not discussing with you. You know, this is our goal and you've met it. You haven't met it. It's just, it's an invisible bar that you have to get over for.
Yeah. Yes. Isn't that fun? Isn't that so fun?
And when you go to them and you ask them, like, so what do I need to do to be successful? And they say,
just make a great show. And then you get a call, like a couple months after you come out, and you get told, oh, you know, well, it did good. We're not sure. And we'll let you know. We're still doing, we're having talks. And, you know, it's like anything in Hollywood. There's a bunch of different faces to it. There's the face that you get when you're signing the deal and when you're coming into the room and when you're pitching it. There's a creative team, but there's also business teams. And Netflix is a big ass place. Like, there's so many people there. You're constantly interfacing with and working with. I don't know what goes on behind the scenes between them when it's not me talking with them. So, you know, we've had some challenges. We've had some moments of real conflict, I would say, between myself and teams at Netflix. I will say that I've been lucky that all the people I've been dealing with, you know, Ted Sarandos on down, really have a passion for the show and really had a passion for the material and felt that I had something to say. And were willing to listen, you know, when I was really having an issue. But I wouldn't say that that made it easy, you know. And yeah, I mean, I look at any of the shows that get canceled or don't come back, and the fan outcry, and there's the petition, and then there's the denial of petition, and some of these shows are extremely popular shows with big stars, Emmy nominations, but they don't come back, and no one is ever really told why. There are very different sets of competing for what that content should be, how it should function, who it should play to. That is a mystery, I think, to most creatives that deal with that studio, with that network.
So, all right, let's talk about the fourth season, which was really interesting. I liked it a lot. It was a departure in many ways from what you've done. Mainly because it became a musical. That was tricky for some people to swallow. I dug it, and I saw it, like, you know, we want to do something a little different. Just for starters, why make it a musical?
Well, you know, because I got to tell you the truth, Trey, because we talked the truth on this.
Let's go.
The fact is, man, is that I really don't want to be like, woe is me, but I was really, really depressed and I felt really stuck. And I felt like I needed to do something that was going to bring me some life, because making the show was killing me. And making it a musical was going to give me some life. Every season of the show, I try to give myself as a filmmaker an opportunity that the industry hasn't given me or that I haven't been able to make happen. And telling stories through musicals has just been in my soul for a really long time, and I wanted to do it. And I also felt like there was a link between what I needed to say this season and musicals. You know, with a musical, there's this like inherently performative aspect to it. People are literally bursting out into song, and there's an artifice to it. But that artifice also like to something that's true, and maybe even truer than if the people were just talking to each other. I really wanted to comment on sort of how performative, you know, racial politics has become, the ways in which like capitalism and a marketplace kind of dictate the things we get to say, the things that, you know, we say that actually catch on with people. I felt there were a lot of similarities between doing a musical and those ideas. And so, you know, I had to go with the thing that was burning in my heart to do. And I do understand that, you know, some people couldn't swallow it. I have to say that happens every season, though. You know, last season we did like kind of like a comfort food season. It was like very broadly comedic. And the sort of issue of the season kind of sneaks its way in. People were upset about that. Season two, we kind of like took on a very like paranoid kind of film noir sort of state of mind because, you know, I was sort of responding to the attack from trolls and bots and all these white supremacist groups in season one. And people were upset with that because it wasn't the same as the first. But we do it. I do this every season. I do this to you every time. And I think part of that has to do with the fact I'm a filmmaker, too. And I get bored with having to tell the same story over and over again. This show has always been a chef's table for me. And I want to prepare things for people that maybe they can't get elsewhere or didn't expect to get.
But the creator has to make themselves happy at some level. And you were depressed because you had depression in your life, or you were depressed because making the show was hard?
Well, because I'm Black and queer. Hello. And I grew up in America. That's why I'm depressed. No, I mean, making the show was killing me in a lot of ways. It really was. It had become very difficult to do for a number of reasons. And none of them are simple. Are going to come out nicely in a soundbite. Some of them are not, just about racism, just about cap. I mean, it's complicated. I think anybody who's made TV knows what I'm talking about. It just gets to be a lot. And each season, I had an opportunity to kind of bring something out that I needed to say and that I wanted people to see. And this season, that's what that was, you know, for me. I also thought it would be fun. And I needed some joy, man. Like, I needed to say something. I needed to express something. But I also wanted to come to work every day and have fun and sort of be excited about what we were doing. And so the truth is, it came from, like, a need that I couldn't really deny. That was the only way I could do it. That was the only way I could come back and do it. And the rest of it was about sort of making sure that had something to do with what we wanted to say and that what we were trying to say could be amplified, you know, through that.
Sometimes you need stories that reflect the community, the culture, the world that you love. You can get some of that on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths, where you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and how to create world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is an account of what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective and diving into the things that we care about and the stories we want to hear that center Black perspectives. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes that celebrate the Black experience. Turn on NPR and listen to Black Stories, Black Truths. Because Black stories make up what it means to be in America, and stories should never be told without us. Listen to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts. Back in 2018, Trump's Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported the parents back to their home countries, while keeping the kids in the United States, separating and destroying hundreds of families. It was heartbreaking. And years later, hundreds of families still have not been reunified. I recently learned about an organization that's trying to make a difference. It's El Atrolado, and it works to reunify families, providing holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in America and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice. They've reunified over 100 refugee families ripped apart by Trump's zero-tolerance policy. Once they're reunited, they help each family find legal representation, housing, counseling, whatever they need to get on their feet. Imagine having your child ripped from your arms just because you went to another country seeking a better life, and you never know when or if you'll ever see them again, and not ever seeing them again. We can't let family separations go on. It's inhumane. And if you're like me, and you believe that families belong together and immigration should not separate them, then join me in supporting El Otro Lado and donate today. You can find the link to donate to El Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gun.fm/charity and donate today. You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved: fill out an application at their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer. El Otro Lado, ELOTROLADO.org/volunteer.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First. Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever you listen.
I loved that it was, that it became a pay on to the 90s and how great the 90s were culturally. And I also found myself impressed by the actors in that, you know, you had bought into most of them, you know, 3-4 years ago, right? It's the same crew and they had been acting and now they have to dance. And not every actor is a great dancer, but suddenly it's have to do this other thing too. And they were able to rock that as well.
Yeah. There's this like punk rock aspect to Dear White People since the movie. That's like, get your fucking expectations off of me. Get them off of me. Get them off of me as a Black show, as a Black movie, as a Black creator. And, you know, every single season, I want to bring something that's going to surprise you. Like, I knew that, of course, Logan could dance because she, you know, was in a dance show. But I knew Ashley could sing. She has this, like, musical number, frankly, in season two. She sings Tyrone. But I also knew Marquis could tap dance. I just knew that there was, like, these other sides to these people. And if nothing else, I wanted to create something where we would just leave it all on the fucking floor. With all of the buzz and the recognition that the show gets and that they get, it's not nearly close to what they deserve. And I wanted to show them, you know what I mean? Like, I wanted to show the people what these guys could do. And so there was a little bit of that in it too. I mean, that was kind of important to me to do it with, of course, the people. We had this sort of like fake audition, I say fake because nobody was like going to lose their part or something, but we were just trying to figure out where everybody was at the beginning stages of this. And looking at the 90s songbook, it's the first time you get like singers, particularly Black singers, where their personality is more important than, say, like their vocal ability. You know, you get Janet Jackson as a huge superstar. And it's not because she can sing better than Whitney Houston, but it's because her personality is exciting. And it's being expressed through the way she sings and the way she dances and all this stuff. And so the song just seemed to fit what they were bringing at this audition space. I also kind of have an axe to grind, which I always do.
What's that?
Which is about the fact that musicals in general are so white that they owe their entire existence to Black culture. Every piece of a musical that we love, down to tap dancing, the movements, all that stuff was mined from Black culture. And yet Black people very rarely get to be at the focus of a musical. There was something that I just felt very proud about, putting Black people in the center of a musical and celebrating Black culture in that way.
Is there one scene that was harder just creatively to pull off than the others?
Yeah, I think the scene where Marquis is tap dancing in the gun range was really difficult because, and I got to be honest, I don't know that I, I like it a lot, but I wish I had days to shoot that. You know, if we were doing a movie or something, or if we were white people, we would have days to have shot that. It was difficult because there's so many tiny movements in a tap dance that as a filmmaker, I wanted to cover and I wanted to be able to show you that, then show you that, then show you that, and then show you that. It was very intricate what he was doing. But it was also like this really emotional moment that is meant to sort of, you know, we're seeing this guy who's been put upon by society time and time again, who's been struggling with PTSD from his experiences at this school. And he's turning that pain into something that has value for him, into an idea. And so there was a lot that had to accomplish. It wasn't just about being dazzled by Marquis's ability, but it also had to showcase, you know, Marquis's remarkable singing and dancing abilities, but also make a political statement, make a satirical statement, have an emotional catharsis. There's just a lot going on in that scene. But, you know, it was really satisfying, I have to say, to get to shoot it. And then to even just watching it, you know, it brings me to tears.
It's a powerful scene. It's definitely a powerful scene. One of the things I loved about this season is that you brought in some new folks who are pushing the old folks, who are like, you're not woke enough. You're not black enough. You're not going hard enough, which I think is would probably happen to some millennials from some Zoomers or from to some Xers from millennials. You know, especially the challenge that Sam faces. It's almost like the show is like pushing her off the stage. Like the character's like coming onto her show and telling her about herself. She's like, damn, can I live? I'm about to graduate. Yeah. Like, what the hell?
Yeah. I mean, who in this space can't relate to that? You know, it's sort of, it's what happens. It's what happens in every generation. I mean, you can go all the way back to the Harlem Renaissance and see it. The new kids on the block got to shoot down the old kids on the block, because the thing is that we're all trying to challenge the status quo. And the minute you do that, you become the status quo. And it is really disorienting when black people on Twitter turn on you, or like when an activist movement doesn't fuck with something you've said or done. It's like, on top of all the other things that need to happen in that moment, communication, hearing what the other has said, yada, yada, yada. It's just disorienting because these are my people, right? I thought these were my people. And it happens every time. You go, you know, we sort of think about people like Martin Luther King in these sort of rarefied, sainted kind of ways. You know, watch any documentary or read any biographies about Martin Luther King. And he was constantly being challenged by newcomers in the civil rights space. Like, people did not like him. Black people did not fuck with him. They were angry with him. And yet, what do? You don't abandon the movement. You don't abandon your cause. You don't abandon your passions. So how do you make peace with that? That's certainly a part of getting older, I think, and being an activist and being a person who wants to make art about things that matter. Certainly something I've had to grapple with. I think it's something everybody on my staff and all the actors, we've all had to grapple with it.
And you do it not just racially. It also happens with the queer characters, that they're like, you know, like, you can be outer, you can be prouder, you can be bigger, you can have meaning to your stuff. Like, don't compromise at all, which is a really powerful message.
Yeah, I think so. And it's, you know, it's funny because the movie, you know, I remember sitting, I had this conversation with Tyler Perry, and I've talked about this a couple times, where he called me up and was like, yo, do we have a problem? And I was like, no, absolutely not. Because my first, you know, the first thing you hear from the movie is, fuck Tyler Perry. And I was doing, at that time in my career, and I told them this, I was doing the very thing that like people do to me now, and that Joy's character Aisha is doing to Sam, which is, you're cutting your teeth on the status quo. You're pointing out the things that aren't there yet, and that's how you're getting attention. And I think it's kind of part of the process. But at the same time, I felt really sad that I had done that to him, and especially because it had happened to me just as soon as the movie came out. I was sitting in Q&As where queer people were telling me that I was not queer enough and that the movie wasn't queer enough. Black wow. people telling me it was not radical enough. This is 2014.
Right.
You know, so that's only continued, and that happens every year. And I think it's okay that happens. But it's really weird to know what to do when you're in the middle of that. And I needed to speak to that.
It's interesting to hear about how many people Tyler has called to be like, why are you talking about? Because he called me. Like, I saw what you said about me on CNN and da da da, and we need to talk about this. And you know, we had a very fruitful conversation and it changed the relationship.
Same.
But you know, there's many people that he picked up the phone and be like, why, what, keep my name out your mouth?
Well, it's, you know what it is? It's like, it's just really lonely, honestly, creating work and being a voice. You know, like you're a voice, you know what I mean? It's like you represent, you're speaking on behalf of people. When you talk, when I talk, I'm doing the same thing. And it can be really alienating and lonely, you know, and you want, what you want is community with all the other people that are in the arena doing the same thing.
I don't think he wants community with the other creators the same way.
Okay.
Like, I think you do, right? Like, I think, you know, I mean, Spike does whatever. We wouldn't even talk about his art if it wasn't commercially successful, right? Mm. If Spike has a commercial bomb, we're still going to talk about it creatively. Maybe it was good, maybe it wasn't good. He's in a different category, and you know, he's different. He's different. He's not studying the art. You know, like I could talk to you about like film history and TV history, and you're coming from, you know, he's not. That's not where he's coming from. So it's, so when people like us attack him, he's like, I'm confused. Why are you bothering me?
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, I have a respect for it though, because like, I think he's in a lane that's valid. And then a lane that sort of like is necessary and needed. And that I feel, you know, in some ways is kind of, who am I to sort of say that that kind of expression is not okay, or it's not as good as mine? Mine is different. The way I go about my work is different, but what I was called to do is different. What I think he was expressing to me.
We live in a world where you can get anything you need delivered to your door thanks to DoorDash. If you don't want to do the dishes or you feel a little sick, let DoorDash bring dinner tonight. My family uses DoorDash all the time because it connects us to our favorite restaurants without us having to drive. Last night, we got some Indian food for my wife, some gumbo for me, and sushi for the kids. And everyone was happy, and we didn't have to do the dishes. The process of ordering was quick and easy, and I love DoorDash for real. So I was so happy to do this for them because I'm a customer, because I know DoorDash is your door to more. Must be over 21 to order alcohol. Alcohol available only in select markets. DoorDash, your door to more. Download the DoorDash app now to get almost anything delivered. In my mind, the greatest author of the 20th century is Toni Morrison. And her greatest novel is Song of Solomon. A mesmerizing coming-of-age masterpiece that is gorgeously written and has captivated readers around the world. The protagonist, Milkman Dead, was born shortly after a neighborhood eccentric hurled himself off a roof in a vain attempt to fly. For the rest of his life, Milkman is trying to fly. As Morrison follows Milkman on a quest to uncover his roots and find the place of his family's origin, she introduces an entire cast of strivers and liars and assassins and the inhabitants of an amazing, beautiful, fully realized black world. The New Yorker said Morrison moves easily in and out of the lives and thoughts of her characters, luxuriating in the diversity of circumstances and personalities. Toni Morrison is a genius. She's one of the greatest writers of her time, of the century, and Song of Solomon is her greatest book, in my opinion. It's a must-read that will ignite your imagination and show you what the best possible fiction writing is like. And it's a timeless tale that will stay with you after you've turned its final page. When you get to the climax, you will feel it in your heart. Available now at tonimorrison.com or wherever books are sold.
The way I can only speak to our conversation is this feeling of like, why are we fighting like crabs in a barrel? And I agree with him on that. I think a lot of times we're just fighting for the scraps, and we're not realizing how powerful we could be together. You know, it's not that Pollyanna-ish in practice, of course, but at least that's what, you know, that's what he was trying to express to me. And I certainly don't disagree with that.
One of the things that I love about this season, that definitely challenged me about this season, you have multiple timelines going at once in terms of like we see them in the future. And yeah. So your production design has to design what will things look like in the future, which is really interesting. Sam has this mask that is freaking me out. You know, some of the clothes are freaking me out. And it's not the future typically looks very like silver, very utilitarian, very useful and pragmatic. And you're like, no, the future. Talk about how you guys decided to design the future.
Well, I wanted to show as little of it as possible for this very reason, because I don't.
Because it's a challenge.
I didn't think that we would frankly have the time or the resources to like have an intelligent creative process by which we design the future. You know what I mean? And like all the ways in which it would be. So I wanted to, one, limit things to like this bookstore, which is, you know, pretty much a weed store with like a section of books in it that we meet Lionel in the beginning, or like try to keep it really simple so that the focus wasn't necessarily like what the future looks like, but what going to the future is, you know, in terms of a narrative sense. But this is Afrofuturism. And the thing about Afrofuturism is that it's rambunctious, it's experimental, because it doesn't happen very often. We're not even aware that that's how we see the future. It's no one announces it, you know, but like everything that takes place in the future is based on, you know, designs from a very specific group of people. And so you start to apply blackness to that, and it produces all kind of shit you just never thought of and never really saw before. That's to me what's so fun about Afrofuturism. And that's to me what's so important and political about Afrofuturism, because what it says is that like, yo, like the future is going to have us in it though. And it's going to have all of this culture that y'all are not taking into account. And so you can't predict it, and you can't tell me it's going to look like sleek gray all the time, because your future doesn't have me in it. I'm going to put myself in your future, and I'm going to bring my ideas to it. That's what Afrofuturism says. And so, you know, you talk about that mask. Man, that mask came on set. It's the first time I'd ever seen it. Ceci, our costume designer, who is a genius, and I have a habit of hiring people who I think are geniuses and letting them be them. And that mask came on set without being announced, without being shown to me before. And I had a moment with it, and I was like, you know what, though? I get it. If we're in a scenario where we're wearing masks for the next 10 years, if, and I pray to God we are not, but if we are, people are going to start to get really creative. People are going to find a way to express themselves through those damn masks. And they're going to function in ways that we don't really think of now, because they're fighting off things that we can't really imagine. And so, you know, if there was like a thread of logic that I found interesting or that I found complimentary, you know, I felt like it was my job to sort of let it be, sort of let it be in the piece. And that's really how my production designer, Greg Grande, Ceci, my costume designer, approached it. And I think we got some really weird shit in there as a result. And I couldn't be happy.
Definitely. You know, to you. You're pushing, you're looking forward to gender boundaries being pushed, or at least sartorially. I'm forgetting the brother's name, but the light-skinned brother who ends up with a gigantic earring.
Yeah, Jamar Al, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah,
like he's straight, but he's now rocking a gigantic earring. So
yeah, I mean, you're skirt.
Yeah. So you guys are saying like, hey, you know, like we're going to continue to, you know, break down the walls.
I mean, it's happening whether we like it or not. You know what I mean? Like the young generation, they're wearing skirts on the red carpet. We're wearing harnesses that used to only be for like gay sex clubs on the red carpet. Gender is being deconstructed as we speak. And one of the many things that I have to do with my work, because it's essential to my personal survival, is I have to build bridges between Black communities and queer communities. because I'm both of those things. And coming up in the world, neither side, neither community really knew what to do with me. And I didn't always feel at home in either community. And so for me to just feel like I can be free and be myself, I have to build these bridges inside. And my work does that too. I think in a lot of ways, and I think maybe people aren't totally conscious of it, but I think some of the why is this a musical animus is kind of about that, to be honest with you. There's a queer undertone to Dear White People that's always been there, and it gets a little louder each season. And not everybody wants that. But too bad. Like, this is what everybody doesn't want me. But God damn it, I get to be here. And I get to express myself. And frankly, I think queer and Black communities we've depended on each other for a really long time in this country. And I think it's really sad to see, you know, division. So I'm always trying to build a bridge between those two communities.
I mean, when you started this journey with Dear White People, you were making an independent film.
Yeah.
And now the success of this has opened you up. And you write, like, you can get a meeting with pretty much anybody now. You can pitch pretty much anything you want to anybody. It may or may not get bought, but, like, you know, doors are pretty much open to you now, right?
Yeah. I mean, it certainly has paved a path, and it made it so that I don't have to be on fucking social media all the time just for people to think I'm important enough to take a meeting with or something. Mm-hmm. And I, believe you me, I have not wasted. I'm not a fan of wasting any opportunities like that, which is, you know, kind of me where I'm at right now.
So, okay, you don't want to waste the opportunity. What is the dream that you want to bring to a small or large screen in the next 5-6 years?
Well, the dream I'm working on right now is the Haunted Mansion for Disney. And
that was your dream?
What I'm getting to do with it was, it's not my script. You know, someone named Katie Dipple wrote the script, and I'm sort of polishing it and doing sort of for the studio and for the actors and stuff. But to do something on that big a canvas absolutely has been my dream. To do something with a lot of heart that I think is saying something really true and really important, but at the same time is entertaining and sort of broadly appealing. And so it can be financed at this level, and we can take the time to shoot it this way. And we can sort of really, like, you know, like I start working on Monday. We're shooting, 3/8 of a page on Monday. Do you know how crazy that is? Like, 3/8 of a page on Monday. That's all we're, like, not to say that's all we're doing. We've got a lot to do. It's got special effects. We have a lot to do. But, you know, Dear White People or any TV show, normally you're like 8 pages a day, 12 pages a day. You know, you gotta go. And I have a lot of ambition as an artist. I want a lot of canvas space as an artist. And so to be able to work at that level is really exciting. But there's also a bunch of small stories in me too. There's a bunch of small stories and personal stories that I simply have not had enough power to tell. And so there's like a dual track when you work in Hollywood, because it's not just about, like, expressing yourself, like gaining influence and power so that you can put it together the way you need to, you got to kind of work both of those angles, you know?
Who's your star in Haunted Mansion?
Lakeith Stanfield.
Wow. He is such a great artist.
He's amazing.
I'm always surprised by his choices. I'm always moved by his intensity. He is a true artist as an actor.
It's true. And such a vulnerable artist and sweet person and kind person. Somebody who really brings themselves to his work. I mean, I told him about Judas and the Black Messiah. He had an impossible job, which is to make us feel empathy for this character who is literally Judas. He betrays his roots. And yet by the end of that movie, I'm totally caught up in him. And I care about him, and I care about what happens to him. That is kind of an impossible task. And so Lakeith sort of finds a way to pull us into spaces and characters that we otherwise would be repelled from. That's a really powerful for an actor. Not everybody can do that. I'm just so honored to be working with him because, you know, it's a Disney movie. It's fun. It's got set pieces. It's going to be really entertaining, but I take my work really seriously. You know, I'm not here to just entertain. Like I feel what I do on a really deep level. And so does he. And, it's just really fun to kind of be in an environment where we actually get to do that and to fulfill our ambitions on the scale that we want to.
You're saying you don't want to just entertain, you want to what?
I think that, and I don't mean this, you know, in a culturally appropriative way. I don't know what other word I should use, but I think that storytellers really are shamanic in some ways. I do. I feel like before we had filmmakers and writers and poets and painters, shamans, and we had people and the tribe whose job it was to sort of connect us to our spirit and to heal us and to sort of help us work through things that, you know, thinking about them or going to the doctor or eating the right things can't do. Life is really complicated. It's really difficult, especially for people of color to navigate. And so, you know, part of my job is to heal. I mean, that sounds really Pollyanna-ish, but it's to heal. My when I make something, it has to work in the same way a dream does. You know, when you have a really powerful dream, like something's gotten worked out in your subconscious while you were asleep in a way that it couldn't get worked out in everyday life, because everyday life is too specific, it's too literal, it's too practical. Sometimes you have to go to dreams and art to really move emotionally past something that's going on in your life. And I provide people, I mean, what a storyteller does is you provide them these dreams, really, to get lost in, and they can work out some shit that they couldn't work out in a different place. And I take it really seriously. That's what I'm here to do.
Yeah, if you do your work right, you take me to a place, to a situation that I may or may not have experienced, and I can start to see how do other human beings handle that? You know, what would I do? And, you know, what feelings might I feel, might other people feel in encountering this love situation, this dramatic situation, this, you know, emotional, whatever it might be. So yeah, it's, you could help if you do it right, you could help introduce me to a deeper self.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's what gets me up in the morning about what I do. And the funny thing about that is that it doesn't always feel good. You know, like a massage is a very enjoyable form of self-care. Getting a shot may not be, but they are both good for you, depending on the shot, depending on the kind of massage. You know, and is I think at its best, it's healing. But it doesn't always feel good. And I tend to gravitate towards the art that is, you know, there's a sugar in with the medicine, but there's also something challenging about it. You know, I like art to kind of give me a bit of a jolt. Like I like leaving a story, not just feeling comforted, but feeling like I expanded some part of me. Like I'm thinking a little bit bigger than I thought when I came in there, because I had to grapple with something when I watched it.
So we talked a bunch about the exhaustion with the Dear White People situation in specific, but you still love this career.
Oh my God. It's what I'm meant to do. You know, I get frustrated when people, you know, I had to come with this metaphor to sort of work out what I was frustrated about. So please forgive me, cause it's a little pretentious, but, you know, I get frustrated cause I provide a chef's table sometimes. And when you go to a chef's table, you don't really get to choose the menu. You trust that the chef is going to put something together, and you're there because you want to experience the chef's point of view. And they're here to show you things. And the reason you do that is because, like, you don't like all the courses. Like, if you might like one or two of them a lot, and you can expand your palate, you can expand your pleasure, and you can like experience the world in this guy's point of view or this woman's point of view in a way that you just didn't expect when you got there. What I get frustrated is when people show up to a chef's table and go, well, why didn't you make me a cheeseburger? That's really frustrating because you can get a cheeseburger anywhere. But I didn't wake up in the morning to make a cheeseburger. You know what I mean? So I sort of, that's not what God called me to do. You know, it can be frustrating when people come to you for something that you didn't really show up to give them. But at the same time, there's nothing else I'd want to do, man. It was in me before there was a me. I don't know how else to put it. Like, I wanted to be a filmmaker before I had a word for it. Certainly nobody in my family thought of that as a job. It wasn't an influence from anyone or thing. It was there since I was a little kid. So wow. I don't think that's going anywhere.
Wow. What can you tell us about Lando?
Not a thing. Not a damn thing. That's the way they do it, man.
But you are working on something for Disney about Lando Calrissian.
I worked on something for Disney for about a year and a half, or for Lucasfilm, rather, which is part of Disney, for about a year and a half on Lando. And, you know, there's a lot of moving parts over there. So while we figure out if other parts can come into play, I'm doing something else.
Congratulations on this, on getting, on wrapping the whole Dear White People experience, on launching into the Haunted Mansion experience. My God, if there was somebody who wanted to have your career path, somebody like me, one is like, I want to do some TV, maybe a movie, da 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 da. What would you tell them?
This career is crazy. Like, Hollywood is nuts, you know. Everyone in Hollywood is really good at performing. And so you literally are in a funhouse mirror all the time where you're not sure who's telling you the truth and if this is going to happen or that. You don't know. So you really have to build a strong sense of self. It forces you to do that. You hear about all these people that sort of like, you know, fall into these scandals or have drug addictions or do, you know, it's because like this, it'll kill you if you don't have a really solid sense of self. It is the most important thing, to be honest. It is more important than creative inspiration, because creative inspiration without a solid sense of self will kill you. It will kill you. In Hollywood, what Hollywood asks you to do is take your personal, like, divine energy and spirit and turn it into something that's going to make money. It's a really, it's not a very wholesome process unless you take great care to take care of yourself and how that process unfolds. I know that's really esoteric, but it's true. It's truest things I know. It's one of the things I know for sure. As Oprah would say.
Thanks so much to Justin for a great interview, and thanks to you for listening. Torre Show gives you fuel to power your dreams, because you can use your dreams like a rocket ship to blast you into a life you never imagined. You can make your dreams a reality, and maybe this show can help. You can find me on Twitter at Torre and on Instagram at Torre Show. Torre Show is written by me, Torre, and produced by Jackie Garifano. Our editor is Ryan Woodhall. Our photographers are Chuck Marcus and Shonda Covington and Nick Karp. Our booker is Claudia Jean. And we're distributed by DCP Entertainment. And we will be back on Wednesday with more amazing guests, because the man can't shut us down.